Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence. All right, if you've got your Bibles this morning, if you want to find Revelation chapter 2, we're going to be reading verses 8 through 11. Revelation 2, 8 through 11. Last week, if you'll remember, we started the second and third chapter as we looked at the first letter to the church at Ephesus. And today we're going to continue in chapter 2 by looking at the letter to the church at Smyrna. So we'll read through all the verses, not many verses, just to verse 11, and then we'll come back and we'll do like we did last week, and we'll look at each kind of idea as Jesus presents it to the church. All right, here we go. Verse number 8. And to the angel of the church in Smyrna, write the words of the first and the last who died and came back to life. I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich, and the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison, that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. Verse 11. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. All right, so that's a little shorter than last week, right? Just, four verses, 8, 9, 10, 11. And so let's look at these, though, in detail, and so we can make sure we understand what Jesus is trying to communicate to the church, and then we'll kind of draw some applications into our own lives and see what the Lord has to say to us this morning through these words. All right, so let's talk a little bit about Smyrna, the city of Smyrna. The city of Smyrna was located about 35 miles north of Ephesus on that great circular road. Remember, all of these churches are connected by a road that kind of goes in a circle, right? Not an exact circle, but like in a circle. And so the letter would have first landed in Ephesus, and then it went to Smyrna and so forth and so on, all the way around the Laodicea, all right? And so that's why the churches appear in this order. So about 35 miles north of Ephesus is Smyrna. Smyrna was also located in a kind of an inlet of the sea, so it had a great port. It was obviously a center for trade and industry and stuff like that, so it had a lot of people that went through it. However, unlike Ephesus, Smyrna was very old. In fact, some historians believe that Homer, that's the author of the Iliad and the Odyssey that some of us slugged through in high school. Y'all remember that way back yonder when? And you kind of wondered, oh, what in the world is this guy saying? Yeah, I was right there with you. But anyway, that guy, Homer, some historians believe that he was actually from Smyrna. But he lived way long time before Jesus would be saying these words. However, the current city that the New Testament believers that Jesus is speaking to, that John is writing to, that version of the city was constructed around 290 BC. Now, just for quick math, okay, I did it this morning. John probably writes in about the year 90, and so that version of the city was constructed in 290. That's 380 years, right? So that would be like you living in a house that was constructed in like the 1660s. Anybody got one of those laying around? No. So think about that. The city that they were moving had been around, if this was modern day United States, since the 1660s. Not a whole lot of buildings in the United States still around from that time period, right? But that's the city that they're living in was kind of constructed, and obviously, like anything, they add on and they add on and they add on. But that version of the city had been around for about 380 years. The city was known as having the... Now, last week we talked about this in the parts of art and theater and all that. In Ephesus, does anybody remember how big the theater was in Ephesus? 25,000 people. Well, guess what? The one in Smyrna was the largest one in all of Asia. So it's at more. It's like a competition of college football stadiums, right? Every year, it seems like one college is adding on and adding on and adding on to see who can have the biggest one. Well, it's the same way in this era, because all of them wanted to show Rome how great their city was. And Smyrna was no different. The church probably was started by Paul when he was in Ephesus for that 2 years and 3 months. And that's when we believe that the church in Smyrna was started. And so had been a burgeoning center for Christianity for a few decades by the time that John writes this letter to him. All right. But as we just read, letter reads a whole lot different than the one to Ephesus. All right, so let's jump into it. All right, Jesus says the beginning. So Jesus introduces himself to this church as well, and he does it by using two kind of phrases. He says first and last, who died and came back to life. Now, Jesus did this exact same kind of phrasing when at the beginning of Revelation in verse 18, chapter 1, verse 18, when he is talking to John directly, almost using the exact same language. And why does Jesus use that? It's probably the question we should ask. And the answer is to remind this church of two things. One, he has been and he will always be. Like there's never a time when Jesus has not been around, right? Like, He was in heaven before he was born, and he's back in heaven again. And so Jesus is there. He's the first and the last. He's been around. He will be around. He's always been there. But then also to remind them, and this will be important for what he's going to say later in the letter, that he conquered death, hell, and the grave. Right? So it's a reminder that the person that is speaking to them is not some rando who's just, you know, out here doing his own. But no, he literally died on the cross, Easter Friday, Good Friday, was buried in the tomb for 3 days, and then rose again on that first Easter Sunday. And so Jesus is reminding them that, hey, not only have I always been around and will always be around, but also I have conquered death, hell, and the grave, which will be important in just a minute. All right, verse 9. Jesus, like he did at Ephesus, tells them he knows something. In other words, Jesus has intimate knowledge of what is going on in their church. And unfortunately, the situation is much different than it is in Ephesus. Look at the language that Jesus uses. He says three things about the church. Number one, I know you're in tribulation, you're in poverty, and you're being slandered. Okay, so let's talk about this. So tribulation is literally just you are having a very difficult time. You are undergoing, the word we would use is persecution. In other words, you're in tribulation. All right, so let's kind of clear up something, because this will be important in the application, okay? They are undergoing tribulation not because they've done bad things. Right, come on. You've met the people. Some of them you interact routinely with. Why is God doing this to me? Why me? Well, you drank for 50 years and you smoked like a chain smoker for 50 years, and now you wonder why you have liver, kidney, and lung problems. Well, that could be it, right? Okay. Or you treat people ugly, you're always mean, you're narcissistic, and then you wonder, I don't know why I don't have any friends. Well, maybe it's because you're ugly and you're mean and you're hateful. It ain't them, it's you. Right? All right, that's not what we're talking about this morning. Okay? They are not in trouble and in bad situation because they've been doing bad things. They're in tribulation because of their relationship and the outflow of their relationship with the Lord. Right? Okay? And so Jesus says, I know that you're in tribulation for my sake, and that you are in poverty. What does poverty mean? They don't have enough money or resources or materials to have the basic necessities of life. In other words, not only are you persecuted physically, you know, for the faith or in your faith, but you also are experiencing financial and material and just basic necessity of life issues as well. So you've got compounding issues here. But then he uses this word, slander. Now, the Greek word behind this word is actually where where we get our word blasphemy from. But in our minds, blasphemy and slander are two different ideas. And so that's why they don't translate it blasphemy here, but rather slander. The idea here is, and I'm going to give you this definition. Slander here is means using abusive words falsely so that you damage a person's reputation. Right? Abusive words, false abusive words to ruin someone's reputation. And so here's the compounding issues. One, they don't have the material needs, the necessities of life. Food, shelter, water, clothing. Like the basic necessities of life are lacking. They're being persecuted for their faith in Jesus. And then a group, and we'll talk about the group here in a minute, a group is intentionally using false words abusively to damage their reputation, which is maybe why they don't have all the necessities of life, the needs, their needs met, and why they're undergoing tribulation, right? So they're all interconnected. Now, who is the group that's kind of the impetus for all of this bad that's going on in the life of the believers there in Smyrna? Well, Jesus tells us. It says, those who say they are Jews and are not. Now, this is kind of the kicker, but are a synagogue of Satan. Like, that's some strong language. So the question we got to ask is, how could Jesus say that? Like, what causes Jesus to say? Well, we can make some pretty educated understandings here. And so what Jesus is saying is, in essence, is they may be ethnically Jews, but they're not true Jews on the inside. And let me give you a kind of Paul. Here's kind of Paul's take on it. In Romans chapter 2, verses 28 through 29. Here's Paul's take on it. For no one is a Jew who is merely one outwardly, ethnically, on the outside. Nor is circumcision outward and physical, but a Jew is one inwardly. And circumcision is a matter of the heart by the Spirit, not by the letter. So what does he say? You can be ethnically a Jew and have nothing to do with the Lord. Right? You can be ethnically of the tribe of Abraham and do all of the things, but have nothing to do with what God is doing in the world. And that's what's going on here. Historically, we know that at a certain point, up until a certain kind of tipping point, Christians were kind of under the Jewish umbrella as far as the state was concerned. The Roman Empire looked at them as all the same. Because initially, who were the first believers in Jesus? Jews. All the disciples. The first wave of Christians were Jewish Christians. But at some point, they began to split. And the Jews didn't want to have anything to do with the Christians. And in this case, took it a step further and are actively slandering, therefore, and by bringing on persecution and poverty in their lives. And so Jesus is saying here, yes, they may be this group who's perpetrating all of this persecution on the believers in Smyrna. They may be ethnically Jew, but they are not a true Jew because they don't believe, A, in Jesus, and two, they are actively opposing God's work in the world. Right? Look, it'd be the same way. It'd be the same way today in a church. If somebody claimed to be a Christ follower, yeah, I love the Lord. Yeah, man, I got baptized when I was a kid, and then tried to stir up dissension and division and all of that inside the church. You would look at them and say, you can say it all you want to, buddy, but you got some issues going on. That's the same thing Jesus said here. In fact, he takes it a step further and doesn't just say, hey, you're not true Jews because you're not following after me and therefore you are opposing the church. But what does he call them? A synagogue of Satan. And again, how can he say that? Because they are, this group are opposing the work of God in the life of His people. So that should take a, let's just take a moment. Quick little application. Anytime we are opposing the work of God in and among His people, we are playing for the other team. Which is not a good place to be in. Right? Not a good place to be in. So Jesus says, hey, I know what's going on. I know this group is causing you issues. And I know that it's causing you persecution, poverty, and for your name to be slandered and for them to use abusive language to wreck your character and your nature and what's going on in your life. Now we would hope that verse 10 would go like, go ahead and pull up verse 10, Rent. We would hope that Jesus was like, but I'm coming out, I'm going to whoop them all. Right? Like that's what we, but that's not what it says, does it? What does it say? Well, he says, do not fear. We're going to talk about more about that in a minute. But then he says, do not fear what you are about to suffer. Now, hold on, wait a minute. Jesus, I thought they were just suffering. What is Jesus saying? Oh, it's going to get worse. It's going to get worse. And all of the language that he uses, behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested. And for 10 days you may have tribulation. And he talks about death. All of that is to point us to the one fact that though things have been bad for the people in Smyrna, because of their dedication to follow after Christ, they're going to go through even worse. Right? Put in prison? Jesus says, be faithful unto death. Why do you think he says that? Because that literally may be the outcome of some of their lives. That may be the end, right? And so Jesus is painting this picture of, hey, I know what you're going to go through. I know what you've been going through. But let me tell you, you're going to go through something else that is on a different degree than what you're currently going through that is going to be worse in your life. However, Jesus gives them these two admonitions. The first one, again, we'll kind of answer the question. He says, do not fear. And then he kind of gives them the little time stamp, which rarely happens in scriptures. He says that you may be tested for 10 days. In other words, hey guys, there's going to be a time where this is going to come to an end. Like, it's going to be for a season. It's going to be for a time. And in other words, just hang on. Like, I know what you've been through. It's going to get worse, but that worse will come to an end at some point. And so he tells them, don't fear. Now, the question I had as I was reading this is, wow, Jesus, like, how in the world are they supposed to not fear, right? I mean, it's been bad, and you're giving them no hope. You're just saying, hey, it's going to get worse, guys. And he says, do not fear. Well, he answers that question at the last sentence of verse 10 and in verse 11. Look at that last sentence. He says, be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. Now, I did a little research. And in the New Testament, there are two words that are used for crown. All right, the first one I rarely like do the Greek for you today, but you'll understand why. All right, so the first one is diadema, which is where we get the word diadem. Right, there's a hymn And then you read it in a few verses. We'll actually read it in Revelation in a couple spots. And the word diadem is used for the crown of the highest ruler. Or in places in Revelation, we'll see it's the one who thinks they're the highest ruler. Okay? All right? But then there's another type of crown that's in the Greek. It's called stephanos. And a stephanos is like the weaved crown. It's like usually out of branches. It's that if you've ever seen like pictures of the Olympic Games wreath that they would give the winner for the marathon or whatever, and it's like the laurel branches that are weaved together and it kind of pokes out and it's got leaves on it and twigs and all that. That's the other type. It can literally be of natural materials, or in some cases they would take metal and they would hammer it into the shape of, they would take like gold and they would make it into like a twig with leaves on it, and then that was still called a stephanos. That's the one that Jesus uses here. So he doesn't use diadem, he uses stephanos, which is a weaved crown. And there, it's interesting that Jesus chooses to use this one. Because there are three touch points where it would immediately translate to the believers in Smyrna. And so I want to give you those three. So one is athletic games. I just mentioned it, right? The winner of some of these athletic games would get this woven crown. Well, Smyrna was known for their athletic games. Like, they held athletic games there regularly. And it was one of the places in the ancient world where they were held regularly, and it was a well-known event. And so yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. Well, here's another thing that they did. One of the traditions for those who were nobles or who were had like great contributions to civic society in Smyrna is that after they had died, people would take these woven crowns and they would like lay them on, like, as they're, you know, like they're carrying them through the city, like people would put these crowns on the dead, right? And so it's like, oh, okay. Well, and the other one, though, is that whenever a visiting dignitary, like a royal or a noble or a king or whatever, would come, it was customary that the city that they visited would give them, like, a crown of the city, so to speak. I remember, and this sounds, like, really weird, but we do this today. Have you ever heard of anybody getting the key to the city, so to speak? I remember when I was a kid, this happened. I don't even remember what we went to. Right? I mean, I was young, 5, 6, 7. And we went to this ceremony and somebody was given a key to the city over in Warner Robins. And I was so enthralled. I was like, he can open all the doors in the city? Like, that is so cool. Like, what do I have to do to get one of those? Like, that sounds awesome. And my dad was like, no, buddy, it don't open all the doors. It's just kind of a recognition thing. I'm like, well, why do they call it the key to the city then? Like, he's supposed to be... And he's like, it doesn't open any door. I was so devastated. So after that, I was like, no key to the city for me, right? So I literally thought it was, you know... But anyway, in a similar way, in ancient times, when a visiting noble would come, they would give them a crown for the city, this Stephanus crown for the city. And so you've got these three touch points. And so when Jesus says that if you're faithful through it all, no matter what happens, even to the point of death, he says, I will give you the crown of life. And so those three touch points have three direct corollaries that Jesus is intending them to see. Number one, the athletic games. In some sense, what he's saying is, hey, if you'll be faithful, you will have run the race of life successfully, and you will have won, and I will give you a crown because you did it. Like, you won. And not just any crown, but a crown of life. And then he says that the correlation from the dead is where in real life they would put the crown on the dead, and now you have the one who was dead and came back to life saying, hey, I'm not going to give you a crown when you die, but I'm going to give you a crown because you're alive like I am, because I conquered death, and so you're going to conquer death. And so he's going to give you, even if you die, I'm going to give you a crown. And then that last one, the visiting noble, was the king who was given the crown by the lowly people. But in this scenario, it's reversed, because Jesus is saying, I'm the king. I have been, always will be, conquered death, hell, and the grave. Now I'm back to life, and I, the king, am going to give you the crown, not the other way around. So it's the king giving the crown to the person for their accomplishments because they've been faithful unto death. And so how can Jesus say to the people, hey, don't fear? It's because what is ahead of them is greater than what they're going through in the moment. And so he concludes in verse 11 with, he who has an ear to hear, let him hear what he says to the churches. And he says this, the one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. In other words, the one who is faithful unto death, the one whom I will give the crown of life to, they will not be hurt by death, hell, and the grave. That's that second death language is hell, which is, you want to read more about that? You can read it in the end of Revelation 19, I believe. And so he can say, don't fear, because again, what is ahead of them is greater than what they're going through or will be going through in the immediate future, that he, the king, will give them a crown of life and that he will protect them from hell because he has conquered death, hell, and the grave. Right? And that's the message to the church at Smyrna. Now, it may not be as bright and cheery as we would like for it to be, but there are still some direct applications to our own life. And so I'm going to give you two kind of ideas and then we'll get out of here this morning. Okay, here's the first one. Number one, you cannot read this passage without realizing that suffering and persecution will come to all of us. Some of us, it will be greater in intensity and focus and nature, and some of us, it will be less. But in some sense, persecution and suffering is a part of the Christian experience. I remind you of Jesus' words in the Gospel of John. The last night he's with his disciples, he says, paraphrasing here, but close to quoting, "If they persecute me, they will persecute you." So far be it from us to think that we can go through life following Jesus faithfully and never experience suffering and persecution. It is a part of following Jesus, because if they did it to him, they will certainly do it to us. So that's the first thing. Can you say, "Why me, Lord?" Absolutely. The psalmists do. Can you say, "What did I do to deserve this?" Well, you can say that. But remember, to follow Jesus is in some sense to experience suffering and persecution in the world. All right, here's the second thing. The second thing that this passage, I think, directly points to that makes a direct application to our life is this. Listen to me. In God's economy, wealth is defined vastly differently. Right? We all know how wealth is defined in our society. I'll tell you a funny story really quickly that happened just this weekend. So we've got three nieces, but my sister has two girls, and so it was one of them. One of them, as y'all know, Holly likes sparkly things, right? And so I've got one niece who she loves. She's the youngest. She loves sparkly things. And so Holly, of course, you know, sparkly things. You like sparkly things? I like sparkly things. Here we go. So the older one, her and my sister were going into the store, and there was this, like, some pink boots that were bedazzled or whatever. And my sister was like, her daughter's named Madison. She was like, "Madison, who do you think would like these?" And they was like, "Ooh, Aunt Halls likes those. She likes sparkly things." So then they go look at the jewelry, and they were like, she was like, "Ooh, I bet Aunt Halls will like this. Is a bunch of sparkly stuff." And then this is the kicker. She said, "You know, Mom, I think Aunt Halls is rich. She's got a bunch of sparkly things." And I was like, if only, right? If only, right? But even she's six. She understands, like, how we in culture, wealth is valued. Unfortunately, ours are probably plastic. But anyway, you know. But she gets the point, right? That materials equal wealth. That's how our economy works. But this passage shows us that God's economy works vastly differently. Because back in verse, I believe it's verse 8, 8 or 9, Ren? It says this part about verse 9. Read it here. "I know your tribulation and your poverty." But what's the parentheses say? "But you are rich." It's like, how in the world can Jesus tell them, "You have no material possession. In fact, you are in grave need of basic necessities to live, but you're rich"? Well, the answer comes in verse 10, right? The answer comes in verse 10 where the "be faithful unto death." See, in God's economy, wealth is not determined on possessions, materials, or none of those things are bad, by the way. But God's economy, wealth is determined on faithfulness, right? You can put it this way. You put it in the form of a question or a condition. If you want to be wealthy in God's eyes, you must be faithful to God. So the question we've got to ask ourselves there, you can ask it two ways. Number one, how wealthy are you in God's economy? Right? Or the other way to ask it is, how faithful have you been this week to God and His Word, to Christ and His mission and vision for your life? Because that is how we find great wealth in the kingdom of God. How are they going to get out of this situation? By raising more money? No. By selling more stuff at their business? No. How are they going to get through this? Being faithful. Faith determines wealth in the kingdom of God. Some of the most impoverished people in the world who are dedicated and desirous to follow the Lord will be some of the most wealthy in heaven because they had the greatest faith. And it wasn't just they said it, they lived it out day after day after day. So again, I ask you, how wealthy are you in God's economy? How faithful have you been to Him this week? Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.